DW Africa Link.
I want to start with this quote by South Africa's late president and anti-apartheid icon Nelson Mandela. To deny people their human rights is to challenge their very humanity. This quote is a profound reminder of recognizing and protecting human rights as fundamental to dignity and equality. In this episode, we mark Human Rights Day 2024 by exploring the state of human rights across Africa. This year's commemoration highlights not just the progress made since the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but also the persistent challenges that continue to shape the lives of millions across the continent. Stay tuned. My name is Josie Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from Africa.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
From the fight for freedom of expression and the rights of marginalized groups to the critical need to address conflicts, economic inequality, and systemic governance issues, Africa presents a complex human rights landscape. While some nations have made strides in upholding democratic principles and social equity, others remain mired in repression and unrest. Joining me as we dive into the victories, struggles, and aspirations defining human rights in Africa is DW's correspondent in Abuja, Nigeria, Ben Adam Shemang. Also joining us for this discussion is a political commentator, Ivan Mugisha. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for joining us here on DW Africa Link podcast, where today we want to talk about the human rights issues happening in Africa as the world commemorated recently Human Rights Day. I just want to start with you, Ivan. How would you describe the state of human rights in Africa? We talk of countries regularly mentioned in the same sentence with human rights, countries like Zimbabwe, Nigeria, also the Great Lakes region like DRC, Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi.
Thank you very much, Josie. The state of human rights in Africa is appalling. Of course, there's a couple of improvements here and there, but the general state is appalling. It's something that has to change. But the political will is lacking to improve the human rights issues to do with democracy, issues to do with the rights for journalists, issues to do with basic human rights. If you go across Africa, especially in sub-Saharan Africa where we live, the situation can only get better. You find politicians, once they get into power, all they do is think about themselves, forget about the people. If you try to oppose them, they still believe that they should arrest people who oppose them. They should sometimes disappear them. Others are killed. So yes, the situation can change, and Africa has had a long way to go. When you look at other continents, Europe, of course, their democracies up there. It's not that they do not have their own human rights issues, but the situation, of course, is way better. If you go to North America, of course, the situation is, and you compare it with East Africa or Central Africa, there is no comparison there. If you go to even Asia, where there is a lot of issues to do with terrorism, a lot of things to do with guerrilla warfare against governments, still Africa, I think, comes as where there is a lot of human rights issues compared to other continents.
And in what ways, Ivan, are human rights abuses carried in these countries? I'm just also wondering, which country can we say that is the red zone when it comes to human rights abuses?
There's so many ways that these are carried out. First of all, is muzzling the press, the media. In the Eastern Africa, you find that the media is entirely not free. Journalists who are trying to cover human rights abuses or investigate corruption always find themselves in trouble with the government or with the investigators, with police, with the army. YouTube, which has come up as a major point where citizen journalism can also do a good job, has come under a lot of pressure from the government, where people who go there now are required to have a level of education, you know, a degree for you to have an opinion on the government policy. It's a bit crazy. And you asked me about which country I think is in the red zone. If you look across East Africa, most countries are in the red zone. Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda. If you look at reports by Human Rights Watch, you will find that all these countries are in the red zone when it comes to human rights abuses. The way they handle the opposition, the way they handle journalists, the way they handle basic human rights issues like freedom of speech in their countries. I can't pick out one country and say that this one is in the red zone, but if you look across East Africa and you get to see what the reports are saying and what the United Nations human rights group is saying, you'll see that most of the countries in East Africa are in the red zone.
When you mention countries like Rwanda, I just can't stop wondering, Ivan, you mentioned also that Europe, countries like Europe are doing better in terms of human rights. But I see that Rwanda is a darling to the West, is a darling to European countries, to the Americas, but yet you're also putting it in the red zone. Then what is happening there?
Being the darling to the Western countries doesn't boil down to whether you abuse human rights or not. I remember we did a story at the East African a couple of years ago, looking at how the trend has been over the last couple of years, where most countries in the West, the US, the UK, France, the big countries basically, are tending towards moving away from looking mostly at the human rights stance of many countries that they deal with in Africa. And why? Because they have a lot of pressure to do business with these countries. Because if they don't do, their adversaries like Russia and China are going to come in, and for them, they really don't care about human rights. All they wanted to do is get concessions, start constructing buildings, give Africa loans. China, for example, they don't care a lot anything about to do with human rights, as long as they can deal and get mining concessions, as long as they can give you a loan and then get you dependent. So the America, UK, France, they all figured that if they continue to look at only human rights as the main thing, then they will definitely lose out on these countries like Russia and China, which have increased their presence in Africa. So I think it's not that Rwanda is a darling for the West, it's just that the West no longer really cares about human rights issues in Africa. And sometimes it depends on the government in power. For example, right now as we speak, Donald Trump is coming in and is in the US replacing Joe Biden, who has had a record with Rwanda where he has called out a couple of human rights issues through Secretary of State Blinken. And right now, Blinken is not a very much loved person figure in Rwanda. If you can read the news that has been coming out about Blinken, it's all negative. Mm. And now that Trump is coming in, all the African leaders need to do is pretty much praise him, you know, and he will give your human rights issues a blind eye. He won't care about anything like that because it's all about make America great again, everything America and stuff. So it's a move away from human rights. Human rights issues no longer really matter as much as they used to do. For example, the UK, when they were cracking a deal with Rwanda for settling of illegal immigrants who are not wanted in the UK to be sent to Rwanda against their will, the UK had to make a lot of statements in favor of Rwanda saying, oh, Rwanda is safe, Rwanda respects human rights, and that's why we are sending illegal immigrants there because we know they'll live a good life, regardless of what Amnesty International was saying, regardless of what the Human Rights Watch was saying. These countries kind of moved away from the stance of looking at that. And it's because of politics and because of business interests.
Oh, what a pity that this is, you know, when you're explaining this, it's just so painful that now it looks like it's all about diplomacy amongst themselves. Yeah. I mean, talking of leaders and making money. But Ben, you are in Nigeria and our reporter on ground. You've been reporting a lot on human rights issues. What is the state of human rights in Nigeria?
Yes, you see, the history of the Nigerian police has a lot to show when it comes to human rights violations. When the colonial people came in and set up the police force, it was a force that was to protect the colonial masters, protect their interests. And any Nigerian or African who was a kind of opposed to them, they got arrested and caged to serve as deterrent. Now, at the point of independence, this mentality was handed over to the Nigerian police force to now load it on Nigerians. Now, all they could do was to also protect those in authority. And that is why today, you could see that some governors who don't like some people, you could see that the police themselves who think that some people are enemy of state or they don't even like them, you see that they become victims. And that's why in police stations, you could see that many innocent people are just simply thrown in there. They've not proffered any charges against them. Some of their relations don't even know they are in such cells. They are not in the custodial centers or what you call prisons today or correctional centers today. They are just being held by the police. And that is against the law. The law says if you ever arrest anybody within 48 hours, that's 2 days, you have to take him to court. But you just find out that many have been held without warrant from the court. And again, reasons are not stated. So there's this excessive on the side of the police. Unfortunately, again, when some people go for bail, you see it clearly written on the wall that bail is free. But I tell you, you still have to cover out some money to ensure that your relation is bailed out from the police cell. We are not even talking of the bail from the court. We are not talking of that of the police station. It's a gamut of things that need some x-ray, some searchlight to ensure that the psyche, the operational modality or mannerism in which the police operate, it needs some change, so to speak.
Ivan, and when you also see sometimes the law enforcement are the ones that are actually doing this to the citizens, as Ben was talking about the Nigerian police, you see that police are the ones that are actually perpetrating these abuses against the citizens, yet police is supposed to be your friend.
Unfortunately, police is supposed to be your friend, but in most cases, police is not your friend where we live. So these cases, mostly it's because politicians look at power as a tool to either enrich themselves or have power over the mass. So they look at police as a means to enforce their power, to prolong their rule, and that all comes at the detriment of human rights in their countries. As you can see, in Africa is where leaders decide to stay in power for the longest time. They don't do that because they are loved, no. They do that because they have the ability to use the police and the army for their own good. And then usually as citizens, when you try to oppose that, you find yourselves in trouble for things like treason or things like disturbing the general peace of the area, which sends you to years and years in jail for something that supposedly a small crime or not even a crime in other countries.
Yeah. Now, just to go back to Rwanda again, I mean, it's a very interesting country, Ivan. Human Rights Watch has on several occasions rather accused Rwanda of blocking its staff to investigate rights abuses in the country. And as we even talk about what's happening in Nigeria, then who is going to police the police? And if then the countries are also blocking organizations from actually investigating these abuses.
Rwanda has had a tendency to not want Human Rights Watch staff coming to the country. They have a long-standing animosity, both of them, between the Rwandan government and the Human Rights Watch. The latest was one of the staff, the senior staff from Human Rights Watch was coming to the country. She was stopped at the airport and told she cannot come into the country, and she was told to leave immediately. And the reason the government did this, as they explained, was that she had come into the country on the pretext of a tourist visa, and yet she was coming to work as a human rights staff. She said she had already, on her own accord, she said she had come into the country to do work, and that's what she had said on her visa application. So it's their word against hers in such situations. But from previous scenarios, you've seen that staff that have Human Rights Watch staff find it so difficult to come into the country. They find it very difficult to confirm things that they have physically for themselves to come. So they rely a lot on second-hand information from journalists, from government officials who speak off record, from NGO people who are on the ground looking at some of these things. So yes, Human Rights Watch and the Rwandan government have been cat and dog chess. This has never been a lovely relationship.
We just want to now talk about the judiciary. Are they complacent in rights abuses of innocent civilians that they are meant to protect in Nigeria?
I think there appears to be some little changes, because there is what is now called Criminal Administration of Justice Act, and that act prohibits the police. Those days before this act, once someone has committed a crime and ran away, you now go and arrest the father or the wife or a member of the family so that the man appears. They said, no, the man you are suspecting should be the one you are targeting. Then a situation where you have protesters in the streets who are not armed, they are just hanging and holding placards. They are not armed. Therefore, you just have to allow them to do their protest. It is enshrined in the Nigerian constitution. Then, talking of the government policing the police, it's for them to have CCTVs all over the place. But I tell you, many of these CCTVs have been installed in Nigeria, but again, the Nigerians themselves vandalize them and not the police. Then the act again has allowed the police to install cameras at what they call interrogation rooms. You can film either live or you film and post, so that you don't go to court, and the accused is now saying he was tortured and forced to accept the crime under duress. As opposed to that, there's also the need for them to use this forensic science. Why don't you use evidence? Why don't you use fingerprints and all that stuff? You know, so that is how government is doing it here. But again, the police are still just not enough to handle to be where you have over 200 million people. And what's the number of the police personnel in Nigeria? They can't be everywhere. And that's why when Nigerians are saying the police are not their friends, you just find the police also responding to Nigerians. Say, okay, if you say the police are not your friend, when next you are in trouble, call armed robbers to save you. And I tell you what, the law allows that every year there has to be 10,000 recruits. I'm not talking of officers yet, 10,000 recruits. But you realize that the Nigerian Police Service Commission and the Inspector General of Police, they are disagreeing with this as to who is going to recruit and who is going to be in charge of all these people being recruited. So you find them in court. They even went up to Supreme Court. And look, it's like they are turning their nozzle against the Nigerian population. And talking of even discipline with the gun, I mean, why is it that it's easy? You have the accidental discharge from the police force members. You can't find it from the army. You can't find it from Air Force or Navy. But it's easy with the police in a marketplace, in a checkpoint, that there was an accidental discharge and three people are just been killed. That kind of thing. So their discipline before the gun is not there.
But there have also been calls to reforms with emphasis to shift from law enforcement to crime prevention, Ben. Will these reforms ever see the light of the day in Nigeria?
That is why every state is now calling for what they call community policing. Every community will begin to have a local kind of police, because everyone will always know one another in every community. If you expand that to the state level, there's also what you call the state police, meaning that every state like Lagos or even FCT or Kaduna or Bayelsa, they will begin to recruit their own. And that will be different from what you call the federal police. Now, the idea is this level, when at the local community level, something is bigger, then you invite the state police. If it's still bigger for local police and state police, you now bring in the federal. And when you bring three forces all together, I think that will show success on the side of the police. And so that reform is there, but you can't reform people who are not taken care of in terms of welfare, in terms of kids they wear, where do they live, where is their office accommodation, in fact, ordinary toilet. You don't have them. You look at even what you call papers for bail. You go and buy, the police will say, they've not supplied for us. If you go to some police stations, a DP or divisional police officer tells you, look, I prefer to go look for evidence after the incident. I said, why? Because they said, we are not armed like the armed robbers. Our vehicles don't have tires. We don't have fuel. Fuel is a general thing in Nigeria. So the police are not immune to all this kind of a thing. So each time they want to move, I mean, you count bullets and give the police. But the armed robbers will come and they are just sweeping ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka in the sky. They can afford to waste all those things. So that scares the policemen. And that's why they said, look, after they've done their robbery, we now go to look for evidence. Evidence, they ask the victim, who do you think you are suspecting? When you mention 10 people, they'll just go and start torturing them to get confessional statements. So when the torture is too much, you just accept, yes, I did it. But you go to court, they're asking you questions. You say, I was asleep when this thing happened. It's because I was tortured and I just accepted that.
Now, Ivan, just to get back to you, a retired U.S. diplomat, Richard Johnson, published a paper, The Travesty of Human Rights Watch on Rwanda, which I guess you've read, in which it says, and I quote, "What Human Rights Watch does on Rwanda is not human rights advocacy. It is political advocacy, which has become profoundly unscrupulous in both its means and its ends." End of quote. To what extent is that true?
Yes, I've read the excerpts of his report. Yes, the Human Rights Watch has come under criticism for several reasons. First of all, their income, where their money comes from. They are an NGO, but their money comes from donations, some of which are from parties who might have political interests in different areas. They are an NGO that are not open to audits, you know, like any other company could. And then they also criticize measuring their investigations on how the Western world views things. And so they lack a lot of cultural context here and there. But I always want people like Goldstone to always look at the reports themselves and criticize the reports, not the organization. Because if you criticize the Human Rights Watch, and yet their reports are less or more similar to other reports, even by the United States Department of State, which has criticized Rwanda on several occasions, especially on human rights issues. Other bodies like the United Nations Human Rights Foundation, they rely heavily on these reports and also have their own independent reports about Rwanda. Organizations like Amnesty International, organizations like Reporters Without Borders, if you're going to criticize the Human Rights Watch and say that their reports are not factual, when you're not providing actually what's not factual in those reports, when these other things are also being provided by other credible organizations like Amnesty International, then I tend to believe that you are probably the one who is biased and politically motivated. If you look, for example, right now, there's a big issue happening in Rwanda. There are 9 people are on trial, one of who is a journalist, and 8 of them belong to an unregistered political party. But the reason they are in jail right now is because they were rounded up for reading a book that was written by a Russian. I forget the title, but that deals with that how to peacefully demonstrate things like
so
that.
So they were reading it in public or what even?
So they organized a WhatsApp group and invited a chat. It was more like a webinar where they organized a group. Then they shared the book among themselves, and they were like, on this particular day, let's discuss this book. And then the government found out, they were investigated. The journalist who attended the WhatsApp talk was arrested because he went to cover them, not because he was part of them, but because he was covering with the intent to publish rumors and things that might destabilize the country. And some of these things, definitely, you understand, will definitely appear in the next Human Rights Watch report on Rwanda. Is that what you would call as bias? Is that something that any Human Rights Watch critic would say is biased against Rwanda? I don't think so. I'm not saying that it's right, but provide the proof.
DW's correspondent in Abuja, Nigeria, Ben Adam Shemang, and Ivan Mugisha, a political commentator, many thanks for joining us. At the Africa Link podcast, we always look across the continent to see how the stories and issues we are dealing with play out or at times even overlap. The security situation in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, marked by widespread violence, gave rise to numerous human rights violations and abuses. To find out exactly what is happening, I spoke to DW Zanem Zaidi in DRC. Zanem, the security situation in the DRC is marked by widespread violence, and this gives a rise to numerous human rights violations and abuses. What are the common rights abuses in Eastern DRC?
As you know, with the proliferation of armed groups, the militias have distinguished themselves, for example, in sexual violence. In fact, the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo is a region where more than 2 women are raped every second. There are also children forced to serve in militias. Hundreds of children are used as guides or cooks for members of armed groups. As a result, many children no longer go to school and their future is in jeopardy. These are the most common human rights violations, not to mention the murders orchestrated by gangs of armed men in towns and villages.
Right. And the rise in power of the Wazalendo, who fight alongside government forces, has also contributed to insecurity and an increase in human rights abuses, with attacks on civilians in the Petit and Grand Nord Kivu territories. How concerned are the people in Eastern DRC?
People in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo think that these Wazalendo fighters are a time bomb, given what they do. In several towns, such as Goma, where I live, Wazalendo fighters seize people's property by force, and they also kill people who resist their intimidation. According to several society organizations, more than 100 civilians have been killed by these fighters in North Kivu province. These fighters also rape women in the IDP camps around the town of Goma. Residents therefore feel that the government should recruit these Wazalendo fighters into the army because they are not well controlled and their blunders are enormous and incalculable.
And why is it that when we talk about rights abuses in Eastern DRC, people, especially those outside Congo, often point a finger at the M23 rebels, yet there are dozens of notorious rebel movements like the Mai Mai, FDLR, among others?
At the moment, they are the only armed group that's active and present in several territories in North Kivu province. Let me remind you that the M23 is present in 6 of the 7 territories that make up the province of North Kivu. So it's the only rebel group that controls a large number of villages in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which makes this rebel group much more visible.
That's it for this edition of Africa Link. Remember, you are not just a listener, but a part of our community, and your engagement can shape the direction of our discussions. This podcast was co-produced and edited by Crispin Mwakideo. My name is Josie Mahachi. Thanks for listening. Until the next one, it's bye for now.
DW, Made for Minds.